Michelle, you better take a seat on the bench. I'll handle it from here.
Okay, well, that's my clue. I know now.
I mean, when's all this madness going to end? Oh, and the ice machine's busted.
Well, that's an important thing, so.
All right, Michelle, this one's going to take a while, I think.
It might take a little bit. I'm guessing you loved it.
I liked it a lot. Okay. I mean, it was really good.
Yeah, it was. It was really good.
But, Michelle, we got some pre-episodes catching up to do. I noticed some stuff.
Okay.
Somehow I watched part of the one before this one again. First, I noticed that Hank's symbols were all over that bar that Hanzi was in. Did you notice that the first time?
The bar.
The bar where the bartender spit in Hanzi's drink and then
Hanzi. I did notice that they had a lot of those symbols up in there. And also, are they on the... There's something that looks like it's written on the... phone booth that Ed keeps going to.
Well, there's a hangman game that's Sioux Falls.
Okay. Well, maybe that's all that was. But it just looked funny the way that was set up, too. But yes, I actually did notice. But
there's a whole row of those symbols like an alphabet, like a kid's alphabet would be in a row like that in a classroom.
Right.
There's a whole row of those symbols above the bar. I just noticed that for the first time. And Michelle, looks like Sioux Falls was Betsy's day too here. To fall.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think there's much maybe about it. There's lots of proof.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if she's completely gone, but I think she's definitely on the downhill slide now. That was pretty dramatic and pretty fast, wasn't it?
Well, there were some clues around it too to make it. Including the music that they played during her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know.
I'm Michelle from Tennessee. This is The Castle 209. It's officially Fargo TV on our podcast feed, The Castle.
Yeah.
Did you look up the meaning of The Castle?
Yeah, I did. It was that Kafka novel. It was written in 1922, but not published until 1926, 2 years after his death, about somebody named Kay and their relentless and unavailing struggle with an inscrutable authority in order to gain access to the castle.
You're not reading that, are you?
Yes, I'm actually.
No kidding.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I don't, you know, I'm thinking that it's related to Lou, right? And his trying to wedge his way in with these buffoons of... the Dakota buffoons.
Michelle, I can't sit here and let you badmouth the South Dakota police. No, the definition I saw, well, I think you're right, but the definition I saw was way more tuned in. It was like, it's a story of Kay, the man who's mistakenly sent to a mysterious town whose residents are all living under the rule of the eponymous structure, the name, the castle. And as Kay tries to seek entrance to find out why he was sent for, he runs into an endless cycle of bureaucracy. Which appears to have no answers. So yeah, the bureaucracy of Cheney and the captain of the South Dakota police and why it's his territory, it's his prisoner. You can't put your rules into my state, my jurisdiction, just bureaucracy.
Well, I try not to read a lot ahead of time, but I couldn't help in searching out the castle and the title and how it was related to this episode. I read Sepinwall, I believe, and he was talking about how they do that a lot of times. They put these kind of, my word, not his, but buffoony characters that tend to want to thwart...
Yeah, he doesn't like them. The police that thwart, the stupidity of police that thwart the advancement of the solution to the crime.
Right,
Bob Odenkirk last year. It was the
exactly
dopey guy preventing Molly from doing her job, and it's kind of overplayed again here. Yeah, Sepinwall didn't like that.
Yeah, not at all, I don't think.
Did you like it?
No, not particularly. It gives you somebody to hate, and I guess it's kind of like he said, they had to get them all together in the end in this one place, and there had to be some kind of strong arm and maybe in some way to get them there. otherwise it wouldn't have ended up like that. They couldn't have told the story exactly the same. It would have, they had to have some reason.
It also teed up some instantaneous fan service revenge when the shit came down. Those cops were the first to get it. The stupidity got rewarded with what stupidity should get you, bad results.
Well, I think we've finally seen the Sioux Falls massacre. What do you think?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. I don't know what else could be greater than this amount of people, but it seems like every episode more and more people are killed.
Well, I was definitely satisfied with the description that Lou gave in his older years as related to this, because that was a massacre.
Well, there were something like 63 people already.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
Or maybe it's 63.
Well, still.
After this one. Somebody counted them all up. It was pretty funny. They have a toll. They have a total.
A death toll.
All right, Michelle, so this book. We see this book, and this book is a pretty neat way of storytelling. That it shows some of the text and pictures of the story as we know it so far, and it also fills in some gaps.
Yep. And it's a different way to start it again, too, which is kind of cool.
The book is called The History of True Crime in the Midwest by an author named Brixby. I think it's all fictitious, but the narrator of the book is Martin Freeman.
It actually was Martin Freeman. I know that it sounded like Martin Freeman.
Yeah, Martin Freeman's okay. Credited at the end as a person in the show, and he didn't appear in the show and it sounded like him. Yeah, Martin Freeman was Lester Nygaard, of course, in season one.
Pretty cool.
So we got to talk about this book, Michelle, and this might be a little bit more detail than people want, but I couldn't resist stopping and screenshotting this book.
Okay.
So we hear Martin Freeman, or the narrator, read the very first blurb, and so we come to perhaps the bloodiest chapter in the Long Island history. So he goes on and talks about where we got to this point. And then we see some cool pictures in the book, and I counted 11 of them, Michelle.
Oh, wow, okay.
The very first one is Rye, picture of Rye.
Right.
And there's some drawings and some photos. It looked like Rye's was a photo of him. Second one was the Waffle Hut store from the street view. The third was a painting of the judge and the cook, a drawing or a painting of them on the floor, dead. The fourth one was the waitress outside in the snow. And from the caption of the painting, we found out her name. Her name is Denise Campisi.
Oh, okay.
Number five was more bodies in the snow from a different angle. Six was police vehicles in the woods, parked in the woods. Seven, I think, was the window washing murder scene in Kansas City.
Okay.
From the back of the people, from like the looking out the window.
Right.
And then number eight was that same scene from the top view. Number nine was, I think, Ed and Peggy's house. It was either Ed and Peggy's house or the Gerhardt's house. Did you remember that one?
It was a big house. That's all I know. And it looked a little bit bigger than Ed and Peggy's house, unless it was just from a different angle. But it didn't really look like the Gerhardt's house either.
Yeah, it looked too big for Ed and Peggy's and too small for the Gerhardt's. It wasn't quite a ranch, so I just thought it was Ed and Peggy's.
Right.
And number 10 looked like the street that Ed and Peggy lived on. And number 11 was the Rushmore store. And then that kind of blended into the real time.
Wow, you caught them all. Yeah, because they kind of flipped through that a little quick. That was good.
So, Michelle, I don't know how to do this because there's so much stuff in this little book that if you caught some of the pages, it was really interesting. I don't know if I should just read it or pick out some stuff. But some of the font and text repeated itself in the pages. And I think we saw that one other part of the show where it was it wasn't just completely serial. It was like, you know, some of the words were repeated on pages multiple times.
Really?
Like filling it in. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Kind of like all work and no play.
So let me just go through some of this. So both Ed and Peggy were born and raised in Laverne, a town of just 3,000 people. Ed to a Frank Bloomquist, a shoe salesman, and Peggy to Nora Knudsen, a single mother who died of breast cancer when Peggy was only 10. Peggy was sent to live on a farm with her Aunt Agnes, a widow. She grew up tilling the soil, the only child for miles around. And in the spring of 1970, she met Ed in high school. At first, she dated his best friend, Tim, who left high school to join the Army during the Korean War. Tim was killed in 1973 on an Army basic training exercise. Ed comforted Peggy in the months after Tim's death, and the two began a romance a year later. Though most of the old-timers I spoke to recall Ed wooing Peggy unsuccessfully at first, but all agree she warmed to him eventually.
Okay, how did somebody find this stuff out ahead of time? Because you had heard the story ahead of time.
Yeah, I don't remember where I saw it.
Yeah, because,
maybe somebody got wind of this episode.
That's pretty cool, because I want to know their secret.
Of how they got the details?
Absolutely, because ever since you brought that up, I was looking for it. And it did kind of, mirror Betsy and Lou's relationship in a way. And so I thought maybe they had just gotten the stories mixed up. But no, since you just read that, somebody got a hold of this early, and I'm curious now.
So it goes on to what we know from the show. Childless, the couple lived in Ed's childhood home. On the night in question, Peggy was driving home from work when her life and the life of a notorious criminal intersected in a most unexpected way. But I'm getting ahead of myself, for our story truly begins in Fargo, North Dakota, a few days earlier. This is when Wright Gerhardt, the last born son of the Gerhardt family syndicate, see chapter whatever, Fargo, North Dakota, 1971, hatched a plan with a local typewriter merchant named Skip Spring to corner the market in a new line of electric typewriters, which were just hitting the market. Mr. Spring, the owner of typewriters, had fallen on hard times as his money was held weeks earlier by Judge, I forget her name, but and I couldn't read it, Judge, the Chief Justice in Fargo's court once over an outstanding amount of $11,321. Some of this was hard to read. It was hard to get.
Sure.
And I was trying to fill it in. So then they talk. I shouldn't read all this because it's probably boring to listen to it. But
I don't know. I love it. I love the fact that you took the time to do that and pause it and got all that. That's great. I didn't even think to do that. It didn't even dawn on me. So.
Oh, well, it goes on. So it was that the Gerhardt's youngest had surviving members. So again, some of this is spotty. So family to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Historians of the region have long doubted his motives, yet he had killed the oldest son in cold blood. But that could be our. I might have to edit this part out.
Well.
Yeah, that's too jumbly.
Okay.
So they talk about Otto. All in all, two men and a nurse were killed in the parking lot of the medical center. Otto, though he suffered fractures in two places on his face, was spared as a message to the family matriarch. Oh, this is a part I wanted to read to you, Michelle, because this is my theory that she had no choice.
Okay.
He was spared as a message to the family matriarch. The message is, we can get you to wherever we want. Timing is everything. In the fact that Rye had murdered the judge, had Judge Mount is her name.
Okay.
Which was also kind of a play on words. Judge Mount, judgment, judgment.
Yeah.
And two others at the Waffle Hut, and then disappeared just 2 days before. The five emissaries from Kansas City arrived in North Dakota, creating confusion in the Gerhardt ranks. Confusion that Dodd, in his quest to wrest control from his own mother, exported to his own benefit. Or exploited, probably, to his own benefit. Or so he thought, by creating the illusion that Casey had killed Rye in a failed attempt to capture him, and that M. Blomquist was not a simple small-town butcher, but instead a contract killer hired by Kansas City. Dodd made sure that his mother wouldn't back down from the war he had started with the far larger criminal empire. In the weeks to follow, there were casualties on both sides. Kansas City made the first move, ambushing Otto Gerhardt and his guards as they took Otto to the doctor. And because some of this repeats itself, that's probably where I got that wrong paragraph. That's probably there that they talked about how Otto got ambushed in the wheelchair.
Okay.
So here's the part. So her offer of compromise rejected and humiliated, Floyd was left with no choice but to declare war on Kansas City the very next day. Joe Bulow, Kansas City's first man in the Northern Approach, was ambushed on a hunting boondoggle with a local zoning commissioner. In all, 12 Kansas City shooters were killed before the notorious Kitchen Brothers turned the table on the Gerhardt's men and executed all but one of the war party. But then, in the waning hours of the morning, the tables were turned yet again as Hansi executed one of the brothers and left the other with a concussion before tracking and killing Joe Bulow. Bulow's head was delivered in a hat box to the Pearl Hotel where Kansas City Lieutenant Mike Milligan was staying. And it goes on, it goes on.
Yeah, this would have been great. We should have gotten a hold of this book and read it ahead of time.
No, I made a note in here that the book mentions no spacecraft in any part of it that I could find. And so that's enough. I won't read any more of it. It goes into more stuff.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. I'm going to have to go back and try to pause that and see what I can find out about that, because I like that.
So the episode starts with this clerk at the Rushmore store kind of getting ready for his day. He sees Hansi approach and makes this torturously slow rotary dial telephone call.
Yeah, almost. Well, and it's almost comical how he looks out the window. He like looks out the window and then he goes to the other window and looks out the window and then kind of does the little comical look, you know, and then he turns around and goes to the phone. And it was just like, you just wanted him to hurry.
Yeah, I might have grabbed a weapon, because even if he gets that call through, he's got to wait a few minutes for somebody to show up. And he had a whole rack of guns right behind him.
Would it have been helpful against Hansi, though, you think?
Well, better than sitting there in the window on the phone.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
All right, now Hansi does some interesting stuff in this store, Michelle. It's obviously an Anton Chigurh tribute again, fixing himself up.
Sure.
With his wound. But Hansi gets glue and hydrogen peroxide, and they're both made by the same company. They both have the company name Trolph, T-R-O-L-P-H.
Okay, that's
funny. Think of
two
pretty disparate things, right? Glue and hydrogen peroxide. You know, you could think maybe glue and tape would be the same, or glue and Post-its, or hydrogen peroxide and shampoo.
Or alcohol.
Yeah, but glue and hydrogen peroxide, same company. And this, of course, is for the wound from the scissors from Peggy.
Yeah, it was a pretty good wound. I didn't know she got him that good.
It was more of a wound than it looked like, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so our narrator kicks in again. Not much is known about Hansi, no birth certificate, family history. All that was known was he was the Gerhardt's man. Then he grabs the keys, Michelle, from right below the We Are Not Alone sticker.
Yep.
And he drives off in the red Cadillac.
I thought it was an Eldorado.
That's a Cadillac.
Okay, sorry.
Cadillac Eldorado. We get the opening credits.
Okay, yeah.
So, Michelle, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the map here, just where everything is. Because we jump around to a few places, and we hear them talk about a few places. So if you look at a map, you got North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. So on the map, North Dakota and South Dakota are almost carbon copies of each other. They're like a little bit more rectangular than square, but they're pretty square states.
Okay.
And of course, North Dakota's on the top, South Dakota on the bottom, and Minnesota's on the eastern side of them, on the right, if you're looking at the map. So in the bottom right-hand corner of North Dakota to South Dakota blocks, you got Sioux Falls. And a little to the right of Sioux Falls in Minnesota, you've got Luverne. And way over to the left on the bottom block, you've got Rapid City, where Mount Rushmore is. I think it's 330 miles, somebody says in the show. Or 3 hours, maybe 3 hours.
Okay.
All right. And then straight up on the two blocks, straight up from Sioux Falls, about halfway through the top block, you got Fargo, right on the border of Minnesota and North Dakota.
Okay.
All right. So I don't know if that helps anything, but when I heard all these places, I was trying to picture them on the map. And also, Deadwood, as in Deadwood, the Wild West town that was on an HBO show, Deadwood is near Rapid City, Deadwood, South Dakota.
Okay. I'm just kind of looking at it right here. I didn't even think to do that. It's almost like a little tri-state intersection area, though, so...
Okay, so the cops show up at the cabin. They find Ed and Peggy, and that we're reminded that they've been on the run for 2 days. And we meet this fat South Dakota cop, Captain Cheney. He's a real piece of work.
Why do you think Lou and Hank called them?
I think they needed backup. I think they needed support. I don't remember them calling anyone, but...
No, but they would have had to, though, right? Because, I mean, how else would they have just shown up there? Lou and Hank were the only ones there, and they were kind of out of their you know, district, so, of course, they probably needed to, like, to be on the up-and-up, call in the local guys, but, I mean, geez, what they ended up with was rough.
So let's recap everybody in that room. So Ed and Peggy sitting down with their hands either cuffed or tied behind them in those chairs.
Right.
The fat cop, Chaney. The Ben, the detective.
Yep.
The despicable detective Ben.
Hank, oh, it's worse and worse, yeah.
Hank, Lou, a couple minor support cops, maybe three or four other support cops, and Dodd with a sheet tossed over him.
Yep.
And Ed starts to explain his plan, and Peggy tries to explain either her philosophy or her plan.
Yeah, she kept throwing in philosophy behind it. We were on a journey, and we're realized, and just, I mean, she does. She just really looks,
actualized.
I was gonna say simple. Isn't that what did Hank call her? He called her something last episode, and but I mean, she just looks, you know, not that bright. Yes,
calls her that a few episodes ago because she's getting smarter and smarter and more mean and tough.
She is. She really does have this. I don't know, just like this side to her that she's able to come up and show some teeth, but then she comes up with just the craziest things. You know, well, we were on a journey. Well, I mean, that's, I don't know.
Well, Lou pipes up and reminds everybody that the Indian Hansi is on the loose. And who knows what he's going to do next. And Ed pipes up and explains his plan to get Mike Milligan to the Motor Hotel. And Lou tells everybody, okay, given all that, let's get them out of here and into custody. It's quicker, sooner than later.
Do you think Hank was on Lou's side the whole time? Because he was pointing out that Ed and Peggy had better luck at least getting to Hansi than they did. And I don't know. I just kind of wondered a time or two. You know, he didn't leave with him. And he didn't seem like he was totally against the idea of the... I don't think he liked the idea of them wiring Ed. But he didn't fight it like Lou did. And I wasn't sure if he was not fighting it because he wanted to stay and try to protect him, or if he wasn't fighting it because he wanted that to kind of play out.
Well, those guys from South Dakota may not have known that Lou and Ed were connected. Lou and Hank were connected by marriage.
Oh, okay.
So it might have served their purpose to let them not know that and have Hank stay on the inside.
Okay.
I just think, plus I think Lou's more dynamic. He's more energetic and, hey, we got to do something. I think he's smarter than Hank. He's more perceptive. I don't know. Hank was kind of mystical. You know, he had these feelings and senses of stuff.
Sure.
I don't know. But the fat cops admit, and they were all fat, those cops, that there's corruption and graft in the South Dakota precinct, so we can't take them right there. They do this
I know. That was terrible, wasn't it? And it was amazing that they would admit that, too.
They admit that it's the Gerhardts, first the Gerhardts, and then the Kansas City people that have gotten their hooks into the police precinct. So they do this, Michelle, by going out on this flimsy back porch. There's about, 2,000 pounds of law enforcement beef on this back porch.
My.
And about 78 IQ points. They were funny looking grouped up on that back porch. So this captain sets up a plan to have Ed and Peggy wear a wire to entrap the Kansas City gang. That's what Lou didn't like.
Right. Not at all. But he was talking down to him, too. I mean, he poked him in the chest. He kept telling him he was outranked. He had no respect for Lou at all.
Well, Ben starts to fall apart here, too. He says, I thought you were Gary Cooper. Turns out you're Betty LaBlage. And Betty LaBlage is the actress in the very first scene of the very first episode with Reagan and the Indians.
Oh, cool.
So she's just a pretty actress. She's not a tough guy like Gary Cooper. So, but Ben starts this whole hateable streak really in force here. He really becomes worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, he just starts smack talking, and it's like he's doing it because he has this this backup. But when Lou calls him on it, did you see him? Because, you know, Lou's like, call me that again, and he turns around and, you know, faces the other way. He definitely knows he's no match for Lou.
Yeah, he's a coward. He when he steps up, he's just like got the backup of these South Dakota people, so he's able to blurt out what he wants. So Lou goes back in and tries to warn Ed and Peggy to just clam up, get a lawyer, don't do this wire deal. And he gets kind of in trouble for that. But that is pretty good advice, I think, for Ed and Peggy to not go along with this.
But is it, in this scenario, is that really a good deal? Because if they get taken back to the precinct, they've already said that that precinct, you know, might be owned.
Not if they talk to a lawyer. I think it's always good advice to don't talk to cops and talk to a lawyer.
I just didn't know because of what he heard, but
well, those are the crooked people are the cops, not the lawyers.
Well, of course.
Get your own lawyer that you know and talk to him or her. So, Michelle, at this point, they started playing some odd music here. It sounded very Pink Floyd-y, like Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. And so I actually looked up Dark Side of the Moon, thinking, oh, it probably came out in 1979. It's probably a connection. But it's not. It came out in 1973. But there's no attribution to this music to any specific artist that I could find, and it really does sound like Dark Side of the Moon, this circular loop of music that it just really sounds like them. I don't know if you noticed it at all.
I didn't, but I'll have to listen for that because, I mean, they usually credit all the music, and they're known in this series to take music and put different tunes and stuff to it. So I can definitely see why you would have thought that.
But it wasn't. It's 1973 for Pink Floyd and 1979, I think, for this time of this episode.
Yeah.
So the fat captain threatens Lou. Let things go his way. Don't interfere. But Lou and Hank have a moment outside, and they compare notes. And then they part their ways until some pretty dramatic things happen later in the episode. And we get a commercial break. So we come back, and the fat cop talks to Ed and Peggy and tells them the deal. He's got a rope, got an invisible rope in my hands. Do you want it? And he gives them the offer of meeting with the wire, and that's his deal.
Yeah, and Ed and Peggy, they sassed Lou, too. You know, they said it's partially your fault that we're here. How did Peggy get that? How on earth was it Lou's fault? And here, they're just jumping for these other police officers. Why would they do that?
Well, because they're on the run. They wouldn't be on the run if Lou wasn't chasing them.
Well, no, they were on the run because they had Dodd. I mean, they had to be on the run, I guess, because Lou took Ed in and questioned him, and he wasn't very nice to him or something. I mean, I guess I can see all that, but I don't understand why they would have just...
They tried to get them to turn themselves in a number of times. Lou did, and they didn't want to do that. Peggy kept saying, well, "No, it was an accident. You know, we didn't do anything wrong. You know, they're on the run basically because of Lou. So it's not a well targeted blame. It's
no,
not justified.
I don't think that they're. I cannot accept that they're on the run because of Lou.
So okay, why is it Lou's fault then?
That's what I'm saying. I don't understand why they think it is. They are on the run because Peggy hit Rye and the Gerhards are after them.
Well, we know that because we're sensible people, but they're dopes.
Yeah, but they know. I know, but Ed knows that the Gerhards were coming after him because of what happened in the butcher shop, and so does Peggy. She had them in her cluttered basement. I don't understand why the anger toward Lou.
That's why they think that. We wouldn't have ever come here. We wouldn't have to go on the run. I mean, Ed thought he could turn Dodd into Mike Milligan and everything would be cool. Okay, rest your happy life.
That's a point.
They're not very thorough.
Like Mike Milligan
at criminals being criminals, Michelle.
They
Cut
are
a little slack.
Okay.
Chaney calls Ed stupid, and Peggy snaps at him really toughly, like unsurprisingly. Sweet Peggy. Yeah,
she did. She barked at him.
She's really growing. She's really becoming realized.
Well.
All right. The narrator continues some more, Michelle, with Mike Milligan at the South Dakota border. And this is the scene that I think is reminiscent of North by Northwest. Do you ever see that movie?
Yeah, it's been a while, though. Tell me what you're talking about.
It's one of the greatest movies of all time. It's Alfred Hitchcock, North by Northwest. Cary Grant gets mistaken identity, and he goes from New York to Chicago. I think starts in New York to Chicago to Mount Rushmore. And there's a scene where he's out trying to make a phone call in a phone booth exactly like this. Exactly.
Like in the middle of nowhere, right?
Middle of nowhere, a crop duster plane comes and crashes and nearly hits him. But it looks exactly like this. But this scene in this episode is Mike Milligan at the South Dakota-Minnesota border, and he's on the phone recapping events with his Kansas City bosses.
Right.
And he tells them his plans to get Dodd, and they seem to congratulate him. Like, this is good strategy, because he thanks them or something, and he can almost hear them saying, oh, good job, Mike.
Right.
Or some congratulatory.
And then he's whistling as he goes back to the car. He feels like he's pulled it off as far as killing the Undertaker and the guys that were with him. And because he was telling them at the very beginning of that call that he never made it, meaning the Undertaker, I'm sure.
Right.
So, yeah.
The Gearhart's got him.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
He may have pulled it off. By dumb luck, he may have pulled it off.
Yeah. Yeah, he still may have.
All right, Michelle. So now we got to deal with Betsy. Betsy's at home doing something in the kitchen. Molly's in her bedroom reading, I guess, with Noreen, kind of helping, babysitting, yeah. Nowhere else to live, living with the Salversons. And we hear this music. And the music is Dr. Hook, and the song is Sylvia's Mother.
Mm-hmm.
And there are clues in here that this is the end of Betsy. She's too busy to come to the phone. She's happy. Why don't you leave her alone? 40 cents more. And this is Lou trying to call her, right?
Yeah. Well, no, not yet, I don't think. No.
Okay, well, I'm going to go through the song because this is when Lou calls her. This is what we hear.
Sure.
So Sylvia's mother says she's packing. She's going to be leaving today. She's marrying a fellow down Galveston way. Don't say nothing to make her start crying and stay. She's gone, Michelle. This is the end of it for Betsy, I'm afraid. Thank you for calling. I just want to tell her goodbye. Tell her goodbye. Please tell her goodbye. So if she comes back after this, it's going to be really kind of goofy, I think. Plus, it looks like they've taken her away when they show that glass shattered on the floor and nobody else there.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, the way all this played out and everything, with everything that went on in the episode, it was terrible to throw that in this episode. I mean, it was so heart-wrenching. And then you almost forgot about it. Do you know what I mean? Did you do that too? I mean,
no,
because
I never forget about it.
I kind of did at the end when I see Lou running around and stuff. It's not playing in my mind that, you know, Betsy might be gone.
It was yet. In my mind.
It was?
100%. Like, okay, Lou had to keep doing his job knowing, like, wow, she didn't answer the phone. She's really, really sick. Maybe she's, you know, what? Why didn't she answer the phone? But I still got to do my job.
Yeah, I don't think he thought anything about it. Because, I mean, this wasn't the time of cell phones or anything like that. And for somebody not to answer a home phone back in the 70s was no big deal. I mean, you could be out in the yard. You could have walked to get the mail. It's not that big a deal. And
I disagree 1,000%. She didn't answer that phone, and he knew something.
No, I don't think so. I don't think he knew anything.
All right, well, let's go through the scene. So
I think if Lou had known anything, Lou would have went home.
I think he's too bound by duty. He's been bound by duty before, where he left her to be alone.
No.
All right, we disagree. Here's what happened. So the split screen is to Lou now, And I guess this song, I went through it. I should have done this part and then the song. But the split screen is Lou at the Rushmore store, the same phone that Ed had used. And he uses a phone to call Betsy, but it seems like it's a moment too late. Betsy collapses before she can pick up the phone. And we see kind of simultaneously Noreen encouraging Molly to show her mom the drawing of, it looks like a cat with storm clouds.
Okay.
So that kind of meant something, I think, storm clouds, something cloudy on the painting or the drawing that Molly had done. Betsy's on the floor. Molly sees her, just says, "Mommy," no answer. Lou continues dialing. Again, it's the rotary frickin' phone that takes forever to dial. It's already cost this clerk his life, and now it might have cost Lou his last conversation. And right at this time in the song, it's the thank you for calling line. And Lou looks over to the window of the store and sees the bullet hole, I think. He sees the bullet hole.
Mm-hmm.
And as he rushes to that store, there's a sticker by that window that says, "The future is here. Keep your eyes to the sky." I think that's a clue about Betsy. Like, the future finally got here. The day you dreaded is here. Keep your eyes to the sky. Phone rings a little bit more, and Lou just smiles. It's very odd that he smiles in this inability to make the phone call connect. Like, it's a realization. Like, she's out of her pain, maybe. She's in a better place. But did you notice him kind of smile?
I didn't notice all that. I thought, no. That's not what I was thinking at all during this. I thought it was first of all, I felt like that happened with Betsy before, because you're not just going to be out of there that quickly. And then Lou making the phone call to her was, of course, afterward, because they've already done whatever they have to do, like as far as calling an ambulance or whatever you might have to do, depending on what actually happened with her. And so enough time had passed. I didn't feel like that he had just missed his last opportunity. I mean, I felt like that probably was missed at least, you know, half an hour or more ago. And
Wait. His last opportunity to do what?
To talk with her. I didn't feel like it was just a moment's, difference. Like if he'd called 5 minutes earlier or something. Some time had passed in between the time she fell.
This might be another point. Like, what does it matter if it's 10 minutes? If he tried to call her and the phone rang and she fell and broke the glass, and then 10 minutes later the ambulance comes, takes her away. The message is there that she's not well and he didn't connect with her.
Right. No, absolutely. I just didn't think he necessarily had any kind of premonition of anything.
I don't think it's a premonition. I think it's just maybe this is it. Maybe this is the time that she's... Maybe this time has finally come. You got to look at it because I think even Seppenwall mentioned something about him smiling, or somebody does. One of the reviews does.
Well, I just didn't notice that, but I don't think. I mean, I like to think that Lou would be the type of person that if something like that happened with his wife, whether she was actually gone or just going and maybe at the hospital or something, that he would leave and go be with her. And if not with her, with his little daughter.
Why doesn't he take a month off bereavement or illness leave then and just be with her now?
Well, the story probably couldn't have played out quite the same if he had done that.
Okay, but you can't bail out like that. If you think he would leave on a moment's notice to be with her, he's already proven that he won't, Michelle. His duty, his call to duty is so strong.
Yeah, but he's already been kicked out of the state. I mean, they have, like, literally kicked him out of the state.
Yeah, but he knows Ed and Peggy are in horrible danger. He knows Hansi's on the loose running around. He's kicked out of the state for 48 seconds. He turns right around and goes right back in. He's got an urgency.
So he's going to leave his daughter, who just witnessed
Mother's
death.
I think that was a good plot point to have Noreen living with them, because she's a teenager who's not leaving Molly all by herself.
Well, right. We had Noreen, and then, of course, we had Carl and Sonny that were staying there with her,
too. Well, the point is that Molly isn't alone now that Betsy's collapse. There are backup people that Lou would have known about, so he doesn't have...
Look, you could be right about it. about the whole thing. It's just that's not what I got out of it at all. I think Lou is going to be floored.
I know you want that to be that
no,
way.
It's not that. That's not it. I'm not trying to project anything on it. What I'm telling you is this. When he's talking to Hank later on, I don't want to, you know, get out of sync with it, but he invites him to dinner on Sunday.
That's and a, I, yeah, that's a don't die on me, dude. Come to dinner.
Sure
Sunday.
It is, but
it's
I mean,
not a real like. Oh, and we're having roast beef. Be there. It's like don't
no,
die.
But Mike, I don't think that you would consider.
Sure you would. Sure you
okay.
would.
All right.
Okay. So he sees the bullet hole, goes into the store, finds the remains of Hansi's medical doings with the hydrogen peroxide. Yep. Sees the We Are Not Alone sticker again, missing keys, photo of the Cadillac. Forgot if we already talked about this or not. And then the South Dakota cop arrives to escort him out of the state.
Yeah, I thought the guy was going to be there. So Lou called him, right? Because that happened. We have to assume that again, right? Because this guy didn't just pull up. And so Lou called
no,
and said, hey.
I think no? Cheney said to the South Dakota cop, follow this guy, make sure he gets his ass out of the state. He sees
sure.
Lou pull over, and he pulls over behind him and says, you got to keep going out of the state.
Sure. Oh, okay. Okay, that wasn't what I thought happened. I thought that he called and said, hey, there's a homicide here. And when the guy pulled up, he thought the guy was pulling up to respond to the homicide he had just called in. But the guy had actually pulled up because Cheney
no, he didn't have time to call in anything. The guy pulled up while he was in the process of just walking around. He was looking at the wet parking lot and the dry spot where the Cadillac was.
Okay.
I think the guy was sent by Cheney. The minute Lou left, mm-hmm. Cheney just said, follow this guy, make sure he doesn't stop till he's outside our state. And when he does stop, he pulls up behind him and says, hey, I've been ordered to make sure you leave the state.
Okay. Well, he was several minutes behind him because, you know, Lou had gotten out and walked over to the payphone and tried to make the call and then walked in and then went in the bathroom and looked around. But
okay.
yeah, you might be right about that, though. That probably wasn't much time that passed.
So then we get a commercial. Thank God for this commercial, Michelle. I'm
yeah,
exhausted
we see
fighting Cheney and Hansi and you. All right.
Well,
and we
also see that the Americans are coming back on in March.
Ah, that show sucks.
It does not. It's the best.
All right, we actually do a podcast for it, and the podcast is good. No, the show's great. I'm just kidding.
The show is great.
Self-deprecating, Michelle. I'm just trying to get on your good side again.
I don't do the podcast with you.
I know.
That's Jamie. Okay.
I know. All right, okay. So the other set of cars and cops are all driving now, and this is where Lou calls Hank. He calls through probably the through his department, he calls somehow and gets them to call Ben's car. He gets a hold of Lou. Lou gets a hold of Hank here finally.
Right.
While he's driving with the guy behind him.
Well, right, because he's got to tell him about the homicide there and that Hansi came in and did that. That's
right.
Important.
So this is where he makes the call after he's already being rolling towards the state line. I think he does it by, you're right. There's no cell phone, so he just gets on his cop radio and calls his office, his police department, and has them call whatever car Ben has, and that's how they connect to Lou.
Okay.
That's how they connect to Hank.
Right.
All right. Hank tells him then that they're all headed for the Motor Motel, which gives Lou the intel he needs for what happens later. And
They had talked about that earlier, too, right? Because that's what Ed had told them that he had set up for the next morning that then Cheney wanted to go ahead and continue with. So Lou knew that anyway, where
right,
they were going.
But Hank kind of tells them that right now we're
right,
on our way to
right.
this moment. We're not
sure.
going back to put a wire on somebody or do
right.
something. We're going there right now. And then there's more Dakota bravado from this cop, this is a guy that's just on like an observation trip. I don't know what this cop was, but he tells him to take a seat on the bench, Junior.
I know. I know they were mean to him.
So they all show up at the Motor Motel, and they pull right up to it, which is kind of goofy if you're going to try to stake the place out. But then they hide the cars, and they switch into ultimate ninja disguise, Michelle. Wranglers and white T-shirts.
Well, there you go.
Who would have thought that? And this is where Chaney, I think, what word did you use? Buffoons? Buffoons?
Buffoons, yeah.
Makes fun of Hank's military service, calls him cowardly. And Hank reminds Chaney that he can still send a Christmas card home just because he can to the guy who's kind of saved his life by bucking authority.
Sure.
From the top down.
Sure.
Pretty clever. And,
well, yeah, it was. That was a great little story he told him, just a little couple-sentence story. But they keep saying how the Minnesota cops are soft. I mean, they really do just keep on with it. It's obnoxious.
It's probably pretty typical between police departments. Like, oh, you South Dakota guys are a bunch of pussies. Well, us North Dakota, you know. I'm sure it's pretty typical between cops.
Well, I don't know, but I would have to think, I choose to think, that if they do that, that it's done more in a joking way and a playful way and a kind of ribbing the way guys do way, more so than the way this is being done, which is pretty nasty. And they're putting people's lives at risk by doing this, by behaving this way and having this bravado.
Yes, they are, and yes, they do. So, okay, now to the Gerhards. Bear and Floyd arrive, and she asks for Simone. So she can apologize her to Michelle. She wants to apologize for being so short with her.
This scene right here, I actually thought that they had messed up. I thought they had messed up. I thought they had reshown the scene. Because, you know, this was the exact scene we saw before.
Yeah.
And they were replaying it again.
Well, we see that a couple times here.
Yeah, that was crazy, though. I kept thinking, okay, why is this scene put back in here? Did they forget they showed us this before? And then, of course, I realized why, because it continued on with Floyd going on inside.
We saw Mike and the Undertaker 3 times, right?
At least, yeah, maybe more. Yes. Okay,
so she asked for Simone. Bear makes some lame excuse for her. Buffalo, Mr. Buffalo...
Buffalo Disco Ricky, yeah.
Shows up and wants to tell news about Hansi in kind of in private to Bear, and Floyd makes him talk in front of her, and he says, "We found Dodd," or "Hansi found Dodd." And then Hansi on the phone says, "They got him." And then the narrator kicks in again, our buddy Martin Freeman. Hansi's next words determine fate and motivation of Hansi. And then we see a couple of flashbacks while he's speaking. And it's Hansi at the wounded knee plaque at the bar. It's Hansi drinking from that water hose.
Yep.
Hansi is a child in the classroom at 8 years old. And then Hansi finally speaks to them and tells the Gerhards that Kansas City has Dodd and Mike Milligan. Or that Kansas City, Mike Milligan has Dodd.
I thought he said, because I went back and listened to that several times, and I thought what he said was Kansas City has him. And the butcher of Laverne took him to the motor hotel. And as soon as he said that, of course, you know that he's setting up the Gerhards. Because it's not just the butcher of Laverne who took Dodd to that hotel. Right?
Well, as soon as he says anything about Dodd being alive, he's lying.
Well, sure. But lying and setting them up. He didn't want Floyd to come, though. He asked for, what, Bear and a dozen men or something to come? And
yeah, Floyd says, "I'll be there in 3 hours," and Hansi says, "No, send Bear and 12 men." So why, Michelle, do you think he wants to protect her and then ultimately betray her?
Well, I don't... good question. I don't think... I think he had kind of drawn the line at her, and when she insisted on coming, it put her in a different scenario. He had to rethink, you know, what he was willing to do. He had already set it in motion. What else could he do at that point?
Well, I mean,
if she was going to come, what's he going to do?
Well, she was a threat. She did have a gun at the time that he acted on her, but it seems odd that he wanted to protect her by her having her not come, and then... he took care of her himself.
Yeah, it was almost like the Anton Chigurh flip a coin thing. You know, if she decided to come, that was going to be the end of her. And I know that's not the same thing, but that's what kept going over my mind. It was just like a...
Fate brought you here, now
right.
I have to deal with it.
Sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's actually a very cool take. Also, while Floyd was on this phone, she was next to a growth chart of the Gerhardt boys. the chalk marks.
I know.
Rye, Bear, Dot, and actually Hansi was on there too. So he was a little boy in that family.
Yeah.
He wasn't some stranger. He was one of the guys getting measured just like the rest of the actual blood boys. And that measuring post, that 4x4 post in her house had bullet holes in it.
Oh, I know. Yeah, from Mike Milligan shooting up the play
truck. Two bullet holes, right in the most intimate thing. You would think they're children growing up. It's
sure.
Now shot up. And Hansi tells her to come at the devil's hour. That's the agreement to meet. That's the time. And we get a commercial. All right, Michelle, come back from the commercial. The South Dakota team is ready now in their fantastic disguises of Wranglers and white tees.
They are.
Boy, they look spectacular.
They do, and they're having quite the conversation.
They may even play some poker.
Yep.
Ben watches Chips on TV and eats Chips. Remember Chips?
Mm-hmm.
Eric Estrada?
Of course.
Well, he gets to guard Ed and Peggy. He's in charge of Ed and Peggy. And Ed kind of implores him, are we doing the right thing now? Like, he seems to want to trust Ben. Come on, tell us. Give us advice. Are we really doing the right thing now?
Yeah, but why? Why Ben? I mean, you can tell Ben's just a buffoon. He's one of the buffoons.
Well, he used to be pretty friendly, and however capable or incapable. He used to be a lot more friendly than this. He's turned pretty south pretty quickly here.
Yeah, he has.
Quicker than Ed is comprehending. And Peggy has gotten wisdom from the heavens, though, Michelle. She's making tea as a weapon already. She's planning their escape already.
Oh, yeah.
It's scary to think that Peggy is now the brains of the Peggy and Ed operation.
Yeah, you're right.
She even tries to give Ed the come over here signal. You know, let's get him while he's sleeping. And Ed's looking at her like, huh, what?
Yeah, they couldn't make Ed look any stupider than they made him look in this. He's standing there literally with his mouth hanging open and, you know, his like hair combed down over his eyes. I mean,
he's a big fat dummy, Michelle. He's a dope. There's no other. That's all he is. He's strong and he's a kind of an ox, but he's not very smart.
Well, he's loyal. He's got some good traits, but as I don't know, it's kind of like they're on this pendulum or something. And as Peggy gets wiser, he gets dumber. And then, you know, that swings back the other way and he might get a little wiser and she gets dumber. And that's just how they've kind of played this back and forth the whole time. But yeah, Peggy's really showing some teeth in this and some, I don't know, like some misguided but initiative, and Ed is just standing there, like I said, with his mouth open. It's crazy.
At one point when they were talking to Ed and Peggy back in that first cabin, they say something about the wire and how that Cheney guy might put in a good word if they get somebody to admit something, and Ed says, I need that in writing. Like, you must have heard that on a TV show or something.
Sure.
And Peggy looks at him like, oh, yeah, that's smart, Eddie.
Oh, I know. Yeah, she did. Yeah, she was very proud.
So he came up with that, and it's probably not too stupid to have something put in writing.
Yeah, she kind of shakes her head like, yeah, that's a good idea.
So then Peggy flirts with Ben Jamin. He makes her say Jamin.
Oh, I know, and he's mad because she calls him officer in place of detective. He's just pompous. He's an ass.
All she has to do is laugh and smile at his words, though, and he's head over heels with her.
That's it.
He offers her a chip.
Yep.
All right, Michelle, Mike and Kitchen head to the party now, and we get some flashbacks of Joe Bulo and Simone. Mike kind of prepares his gun in the back seat of the car.
Yep.
Cut over to Lou and the South Dakota escort. Finally make it to the border. The cop behind him, and they make it to the border. And we get a radio call into the car that Constance is strangled. Poor Constance didn't make it.
Yeah. I was pulling for her. Even though she wasn't my favorite character, I hate that she had to go. I mean, but I also kind of hate what she was doing to Peggy and Ed, too. So,
if you notice the two signs for the state of Minnesota, which looks dreary and worn out, and the state of South Dakota, which looks nice and flourishing and beautiful, welcome to South Dakota, welcome to Minnesota. they are actually the opposite of that in real life. If you think about it, Minnesota is probably a much more affluent state than South Dakota. And this was actually something I picked up from the other cool podcast I like on Fargo Talks Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
The guys who live in Fargo and do this show about Fargo. But they confirmed that, you know, it's actually exactly the opposite. Minnesota has the nice welcome to our state, and South Dakota's looks like crap. And then Lou just pulls a Yui and heads back into the fray. So he's not distracted at all by being made to stay outside the state lines. That was just for show, I think.
I don't know. I kind of thought he was going to do it. But then once he got that call, he's like, no, it's not happening. And he decides to go back to Constance's hotel room is where he ends up going.
Right. So before that, we have a commercial, more Pink Floyd music, and then the scene at Constance's room. Now, Constance's room, Michelle, was interesting, too. I don't know how much attention you paid to it. But when Hansi was there with her, it looked relatively neat and tidy.
Mm-hmm.
And as Lou examines it, it's a wreck. It's totally messed up. So either Hansi fought with her, which I don't think. I think he probably did her in pretty quickly and efficiently. Or Hansi just tossed the room after he killed her looking for evidence. And
oh, that's direction. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
But I noticed a big difference in the condition of the room. Also, there was kind of a clue that Hansi was going to finish off Constance as he was kind of stroking her hair last week.
Yeah.
And the very last motion of his hand was to grab her hair. Like he's going to pull her hair, like he did with the bunny. He was stroking the bunny. He killed the bunny.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Anyway, even Hank now is in disguise at the motor hotel in his Wranglers and white shirt. He checks in on Ed and Peggy in Ben's custody, and Ben won't let him in the door.
No, he sass talks him, calling him pops. I mean, he's so rude.
Hank even tries to shout past him, are you guys doing okay? And he gets the door slammed on him.
Yep.
So in the other room, Michelle, we have the other geniuses in disguise drinking beer. And this is where one of them says the ice machine's busted. I mean, they're getting ready for this big showdown, and they're drinking beer, playing poker, and their biggest worry is that the ice machine is broken.
Yeah.
All right, and then Chaney brilliantly orders radio silence. And
and all he's worried about is bringing Miss in tomorrow, getting this done tomorrow, because then there'll be accommodations all around.
Grabbing credit.
That's all he cares about. I mean, it's like it doesn't matter that the danger that he's putting these people in.
He's underestimated the danger. He's just a shitty cop. He's underestimated the situation. He thinks they'll be okay in radio silence and T-shirts. It's just spectacular stupidity.
Okay, let me ask you, what was the point of the radio silence? Do you know? Why would they do that?
I have no idea. Just another bad decision.
Okay.
I mean, maybe somebody would find out where they were and come in and try to grab credit or try to help. I don't know. Maybe in his mind, it was protecting them from somebody else grabbing part of their credit.
Okay. I just couldn't figure it out at all. Okay.
It's not like Kansas City has radio trackers that can zero in on them.
You wouldn't think, but I mean, who knows?
Yeah,
but
I think it's just more blundering by this guy.
Or would it be because Kansas City is kind of in the know for their precinct,
corruption. They
said earlier? Right. So maybe somebody there would have, I don't know. I was just trying to think of some reason why they would have done that, because that proved to be a big mistake.
Maybe. I just hate to give this guy Chaney any credit for doing anything smart, because he's such a smarm.
Right. Sure.
All right. So the Gerhardt team arrives in several cars now, and they go past Lou from Constance's hotel. He sees them pass by, and he follows them. And tries to warn over the radio that's now just been radio silenced. So it proves stupid, like, within seconds after Chaney orders it.
Well, yeah, and they show them, and they're just all sleeping like babies. Even the watch guard outside.
Even Ben.
Yeah. Just like babies. The only one awake is Peggy and Hank.
Even Ed was asleep.
Well, yeah.
I mean, oh, my God. All right. Hank gets a hinky feeling again. This is all Larson blood traits, I think, Michelle. It's his, Molly's, and Betsy's. this hinky feeling like, ooh, something's wrong. Like he wakes up out of a, you know, for no reason. He kind of sits up like something's going on.
Yeah. And he puts back on his uniform. He gets out of his, you know, disguise.
So the movie playing in Ed and Peggy's room as Ben sleeps is that Operation Eagle's Nest again.
Right.
Pops
right
up again. And this is where Bear warns Floyd in the car to stay back with Hansi. Not too great advice, Bear.
No, but, I mean,
he doesn't know any better.
No, of course not.
He would think, you know, why mistrust Hansi at this point?
Sure.
And Floyd kind of ironically says, I miss them all. Pretty touching. I miss them all. Everyone she's lost.
Yeah. Yeah, she's starting to think on it, I think.
And Bear just reminds her, well, we'll all be together again on high. I guess after we all die, we're in heaven together, right?
Is that what he meant?
I think so.
I didn't even know. Okay, I wasn't sure. I kind of wondered what he was talking about.
The only way they'll be together again is in the afterlife with Rye and...
Sure, sure.
Who knows? Who else does he know has died?
Well, he knows Simone.
His father, Otto.
Yeah, Otto.
Yeah. I miss them all means everybody. And Bear saying, I think on high is the code word for heaven. Come on, Michelle, you're the religious one. You should know this more than me.
Well, I was thinking, what did Hansi say? What time were they supposed to meet?
The devil's hour.
Okay, never mind. Opposite. Okay.
All right, so the poker game's going on, and there's a sprightly conversation about piss, Michelle, the best place to piss. One guy says, my best piss was in a kitchen sink. One other guy says, I pissed in my boss's desk drawer after 6 coffees and a knee-high. And one guy talks about pissing in the pool. And then the lady cop talks about how she doesn't have the hardware to do that, and she would have to climb up on the desk. Kind of inane conversation, huh?
Yeah, I was really... And then the other guy, they couldn't figure out why they didn't like him talking about... His favorite place to pee was in the pool.
Right.
Like, that was just the same thing. It was like, what a conversation to have.
At least the woman cop says, well, guys, no wonder why you're divorced. Pissing in the sink. Kitchen sink.
Right?
All right. Team Gearhart arrives, and they park a block or so away. This was a little... At first, I was thinking, okay, now these guys are going to pull right up and try to do this all in surprise, but at least they parked a block away. I think they walked through, like, a used car lot. From around the corner.
Okay.
So at least they covered that. That was good writing, I thought. They can't just pull right up and surprise everybody. So Hansi lies about the layout at the hotel. Dodd's on the ground floor with the guards and Milligan's upstairs. He knows Dodd's dead, so he knows that's not true. And Milligan, I don't know how he knows where Milligan is, but it's just setting them up to get ambushed by the cops. And then Floyd and Hansi do stay back while the others go forward. And we find out that Floyd's packing a pretty hefty gun there in her waist belt.
Yep. I wasn't really surprised, though.
No?
No.
Wasn't very stylish with a red jacket.
No, but, you know.
A red coat. Do you think there was anything about her red coat and the devil's hour? And
I don't know. I didn't think about it, but I did notice the red coat.
She's worn that coat before. And it is very devilish. It is very bright and stands out from what everybody else is wearing.
Yeah, it definitely puts her in the spotlight. I agree.
So the first cop in disguise is asleep, of course, like all the others, sitting outside the front door of the office. And he's killed instantly by getting stabbed. And then Bear gives the directions, kind of hand signals directions. And Hank, this is where Hank continues on his hanky feelings, continues getting dressed. And this attack starts. The cops get shot in the first room. Chaney is one of the first and most violently killed for some viewer cheers, I would think.
Man, that weapon picked him up, and he was not a little man, and threw him against the wall. That was violent.
Yeah, probably a shotgun. I think it probably would do that.
That was crazy. I don't even know how they filmed that like that. I mean, it literally lifted him. He sat up in the bed and was like, no, and then got shot and then just like lifted him out of the bed and threw him against the wall. It was horrible.
Pretty good viewer satisfaction for the viewers, though. So the poker game's interrupted. Hank's fighting back now. Now Bear starts walking through the room and starts coaxing, I guess, somebody.
Dodd.
Yeah.
He's calling for Dodd.
Well, he's calling brother.
Yeah, he's calling for his brother. And he is... Is it cocking the shotgun, whatever that is, you know?
Racking it.
Racking it. Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think he was going to kill him?
I want to ask you about the word brother, because Ed gets called brother by Dodd and by Mike Milligan. When Mike Milligan offers up Dodd in the trunk of his car, when Ed offers Dodd to Mike Milligan, Mike Milligan says, brother, you wouldn't believe how good that would be. And when Dodd is complaining about Peggy, he's like, brother, you've got to take care of that woman. They both call him brother. And now here's Bear walking through the room calling out the word brother. Brother, brother. So I don't know if he's meaning that for Dodd or for Ed. Because he would have been the third person calling Ed brother.
I don't know. I mean, I think when Dodd said it and when Mike Milligan said it, they said it in a camaraderie kind of way. And I, misguided though it was, particularly with Dodd. But I don't know that Bear would have felt the same way toward Ed. I thought he was just calling for Dodd, and so he was calling brother and racking the gun because he was going to go ahead, because Bear did not want Dodd to come back. We know that.
Interesting. So, yeah, I thought Bear was being on the attack aggressively, like maybe for Ed, like, come on, brother, it's your time. You're going to get shot, meaning Ed. But I guess he could have meant Dodd. And Dodd is his brother.
Yeah, so. I didn't even think about that, but that's a good point. I mean, I guess it could have been that way because that is who he was going in the room to see. I mean, he thought he was going to see Ed there and Dodd. So I don't know. Good point.
So Ben gets the jump on a couple of Gerhardts. He finally shows he has some skills, but then he meekly tries to say all clear. He's like, all clear. Can't get it out because he's scared. Finally gets it out. Ed and Peggy come out, and he says, this is Rapid City all over again. He's peeking out the window. So there's, and then Peggy gun butts him right in the head.
Yes, she does.
So, Michelle, there's speculation now about Rapid City.
That's what I was wondering.
Does this show go back in time to before this time, to another episode in Rapid City now that happened years ago, or what? And I have kind of the answer to this, but I wonder if you have any take on it.
I thought it might, but I'm kind of hoping that it doesn't, because I wanted to go back with Lou, because I liked Lou and I respected Lou. I don't know if I want to go back with Ben. I don't like Ben. I mean, I guess it could make for a good story, but they're going to have to give us people that we do like, right?
Well, yeah. So here's the deal in Rapid City. And Sepinwall talked about this. He says, could it be a reference for another prequel story down the line? Although next year is not supposed to be, season three of this show is not supposed to be another prequel. It's supposed to be after time frame of season one.
Oh, okay. So after Molly is grown.
Right.
Okay.
And Noah Hawley has said this in interviews, that season three would be post season one.
Oh, okay.
But the other thing that connects Rapid City is the whole North by Northwest Mount Rushmore thing. That's where Mount Rushmore is.
Oh, okay.
So whatever happened in Rapid City might just be a reference that goes kind of vaguely by. Or we might get a flashback of it somewhere, or a flash forward. So it would have to be a flashback. But Ben does say that. Rapid City all over again.
Yeah. Yeah, I wondered
like
about
looted.
That.
So more shooting outside. Hank's fighting, putting up a good fight. And one of the gang member yells out, "There are cops!" So we got to remind ourselves that these Gerhardts thought that this was the Kansas City gang, not cops, when they
exactly.
first went.
Exactly. Well, yeah, not just when they first went in, but up until that moment, I think they kind of thought they were.
Yeah,
they were just
right when
you
that
know,
guy yelled
City,
it out.
Right.
So it's also important that Floyd hears this, and then this is where she realizes this is all a trick.
Right.
And this is where Hansi just kind of grabs her and guts her.
Yes, he does.
and Pink Floyd music again, Pink Floyd type music. So I thought with Floyd, the name of the woman, and Pink Floyd, I thought there was something, and I put Pink Floyd in here a bunch of times until I looked up the album dates. But we hear that type of music again as he does that to her, stabs her, kind of holds her up and intimately stabs her.
Yes, it was personal. It was a up-close, personal kind of hugging thing.
Yeah, like you'd stab your mother.
No.
All right, so Bear sees his mother's death and Hansi, and Lou shoots at him and kind of grazes him, hits him in the side of the skull and the ear.
Yeah, I thought he was shot at first, okay? And then I started thinking, is Bear, invincible or what? That was crazy, right?
Or like a bear, like a real bear. Shoot a bear in the head, the bullet would bounce off. And he acts like a bear. He rushes at Lou, and Lou takes a couple more shots at him.
He just ticked off. And Lou didn't miss those shots. I mean, he could not have missed those shots, right?
Well, he probably hit him in the shoulder. He didn't hit him in the head or anything.
No, he didn't hit him in the head. But, he was shooting Bear, and it just made him mad. It made Bear mad. That's
like
all.
Like a real bear would be mad and keep coming at you. So, he tackles Lou and pounds him into the asphalt and starts to strangle him. And Hansi rushes up, and we get this cool stop-action burst, screenshot burst of his shooting. It's the flame of his gun.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I actually made a note of that, too. The stop-motion firing. It was really cool how they did that. That was one of my favorite things, favorite visuals.
Then Hansi actually shoots Hank. And we hear the narrator again. Hansi shoots friend and foe alike. He's on a mission to find the beautician and the butcher and silence them once and for all, a decision that has puzzled historians for decades. And then he wonders why. Is it because they could reveal his treachery with Dodd, or is it because of his vulnerability that he's tired of this life that he revealed to Ed and Peggy? What do you think, Michelle?
I absolutely think it had to do with Dodd, because they're the only ones who know. The rest of the Gearhearts are gone, right? And they're the only ones that would know Hansi's traitor, the fact that he was a traitor to the family.
I think it's the other. I think he's tired of this life. He's tired of being serving the country in 3 tours in Vietnam and being disrespected by getting his drinks spit in. He's being called a mongrel and these awful Indian names.
Yeah, half-breed. He's called everything.
He's tired of this life. He's tired of being in service of the white man and not getting any, and everybody, the family, and not getting any respect from anybody. So I don't think he's just trying to cover up his deal with Dodd. I think he's just tired of this life.
Well, I just don't know that they start off the book saying that he's got no birth certificate or something, no real record of Hansi. So, I mean, both of those really kind of go together, because if he can be done with anybody who knows what he's actually done, then he can go on with a new life, kind of. So, I don't know. I guess I can see that. I don't think they're going to end up with Hansi. Do you? Do you think they're going to end up getting him?
Well, it's interesting how they left the final episode with a mystery like this. Like this, you'd think this massacre would be part of the final episode. But it's over. This is over now. It's just kind of resolution for the final episode.
Yeah, it's very Game of Thrones-ish.
Very Red Wedding?
Yeah, it is. It's very 9th episode.
All right, Michelle, spaceship comes down now. What'd you think of the spaceship?
Okay, I gotta tell you, I mean, it was nuts, right? And if they hadn't shown Ed looking and then Peggy going over and saying, it's just a UFO, come on, or it's just a flying saucer, come on, babe, we gotta go. If they hadn't shown that, I think it would have been perfect, because it could have been anything, and Lou could have visualized that as the life was being choked out of him. So it would have still been a mystery. But the fact that everybody saw it, and Ed and Peggy spoke what it was. I thought that took a little bit away from it. But you and I talked about what would make it okay to tie in the UFO stuff, and I thought they did a great job. I thought it was great. They couldn't have done it better to satisfy me better, except for not having Ed and Peggy acknowledge it. And that would have been the only thing. What did you think?
I didn't like it that much. I don't know if I like it or not, actually. It was too obvious, maybe. Here, let me just go through what happened. So spaceship interrupts Bear as he's choking Lou. And kind of Hansi even cowers. He looks up and sees it like, holy shit. But this gives Lou the chance to make the rare upside-down pinky shot and shoot Bear up through the chin because he gets a second of reprieve from being choked.
Sure.
Ed and Peggy give Hansi some tea and rush past him, so Peggy's hot tea gets them past Hansi. And this is where Ed is distracted, and Peggy says, it's just a flying saucer, Ed. We got a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou looks up, finally, also amazed. So your point is that the fact that so many people saw it takes away its mystery. It can't just be explained away as something that somebody dreamed or...
Well, right. If Lou had saw it, if Lou had seen it from that situation while he's being choked, and it had just been a light that we all saw and we didn't see, you know, if other people hadn't acknowledged it, I think it would have been better. Because then you could kind of explain it away as... Lou, you know, dying and having maybe a hallucination from lack of oxygen or whatever he might have had, there would be some kind of explanation that we could at least rationalize for it, right? But the fact that other people saw it, I thought, made it not quite as good. But I do love that they did tie something in. So something was tied in, and I thought they did a really good job, not a great job, but a really good job of doing it.
Well, they had the spotlights from it, too, on the people on the ground. So that would have been hard to just imagine as Lou imagining it in his final thoughts before dying, being choked down. Well, sure.
Yeah, but that could have been a helicopter or anything. It could have been spotlights from the hotel that the management turned on when they heard all this. I mean, that could have been anything, but it couldn't because
too many people saw it.
Right.
So what's the meaning of it?
I don't know. I have no idea.
That's the real important thing. Like, what was the meaning of the fish tornado that flipped over the Grocery King's son's car? I didn't like that. I think I'm putting this in that category of not liking it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it saved Lou, and that was the, you know, the outcome. The meaning, I don't know. We have to remember
that. It saved Ed and Peggy, too, that Hansi got a little distracted.
Sure. But we have to remember that Hank had all these drawings in his house, right? And Hank was the one that got the feeling about something going on, and he got up and got dressed, which saved his life, or hopefully, maybe. And so maybe that happens because the UFO was coming or close or something. I don't know. I don't know if they're going to tell us anything else about it. And it's okay with me if they don't. I'm glad they put something in there, so.
So you're saying Hank Larson's a space alien?
I think Hank knows more based on what Betsy saw in his house than we know Hank knows about. No, I don't think he's an alien.
Well, she's a space alien's daughter, if that's true.
I don't think he's an alien. I just think he might have had some other kind of contact or something.
If anyone had contact, it's Hansi with his two-hour time lapse and when he was outside the diner.
Well, right. Right, there was that. But Hansi wasn't drawing the symbols for everything. You know, that was Hank.
And Peggy saw it when she ran over Rye. That's how she got distracted.
Yeah, she said, oh, no big deal even. And, you know, tonight or last night.
All right, so Ed, Peggy, and the flying saucer depart. Hansi and Lou have a gun battle. Hansi chases after Ed and Peggy, and Lou chases after Hansi until we hear Hank shout out, "Officer down," meaning himself, right?
Yeah.
And Lou comes back and finds him. And now Mike and the Kitchen Brothers show up and give a quick okay then.
Yeah.
We'll just turn around and leave in 15 seconds.
Yeah, they're like, I don't want any part of this.
So, Michelle, Mike's situation has improved swimmingly with this whole series of events.
Yeah, all the Gerhardts are gone, right? I mean, there's none left. Is there any left?
He can get he can lay claim to the credit for it, like I set up this ambush. And he'll get out of being in trouble for the Undertaker.
Sure, because the Gerhardts did it, according to him.
Go back to Kansas City, get a big promotion.
Yep.
All right, Hank asks Lou and Peggy now about Ed. Or Hank asks Lou about Peggy and Ed.
Right.
Let me say that again. Hank now asks Lou about Peggy and Ed. And here's where Lou says, how about Sunday dinner? And Lou leaves. I think that's just a don't die on me, old man, with your gut shot. It's not really.
Yeah, sure.
And he walks out past the massacre at Sioux Falls. And that's the end.
And then we see they, like, go above the hotel. We see, like, in the distance, and we see the flash of light. In the early, early morning light, there's this big flash of light. And then it's gone. So,
the devil's hour. So that's it, Michelle. 209 The Castle. Do you have any final thoughts?
I don't. This was great TV, though. I loved this episode.
What do you think's going to happen in the next one, 210 Palindrome?
You know, I don't know. I think they're, well, this is an anthology, though, right? So they're going to tie it up. I mean, it's the end of it. We're going to hear, like, the end of the story. So I'm kind of excited to hear it.
Will Lou see Hank again?
I think Lou will see Hank again.
Will Lou see Betsy?
I hope that Lou gets to say goodbye to Betsy.
He won't.
I know you think that, but I mean, you always have everybody dying. Everything we do, you know, I mean, if somebody gets a scratch on their finger, it's like,
I'll put my record up against it. What, when I'm not wrong that much.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. You're mostly right, but I hate that. You know, I want to pull for them. And, so that's what I'm pulling for. Anyway.
I think Hank's gone too. I think Hank and Betsy are gone. Lou and Molly have to figure it out. We'll see probably a sad, sad scene of Lou and Molly next week.
Okay. I don't think Hank's gone. I think Hank's going to be hurt, but he's going to be there. And I think Betsy's going to be gone. I don't know that we won't even see sometime in the future next episode.
Michelle, someday we're all going to be gone. You know that, right?
Well, yeah. But wait, we're not. Because the upcoming scene shows Ed and Peggy running a man out of a grocery store because somebody's coming. So Hansi's coming.
Spoiler alert. I was going to ask you what you think happens to Ed and Peggy.
So that's all. But that's all. They didn't give us much.
What about Hansi?
Well, Hansi's going after him. I don't know. Do you think Peggy's going to end up taking Hansi out? Hansi, who
on
can't
a date?
No, not on a date. Who can't be touched.
So Hansi, to protect Ed, she takes on Hansi? Maybe.
Who knows? Or maybe she runs off with Hansi.
I don't think so. So we don't have much of a connection to the movie like we had the money. You think the money will show up? The money in the snow that the grocery king found to start his empire? That was a pretty direct connection to Fargo the movie, and we don't have that yet.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Because there's all kinds of hints about all kinds of Coen Brother projects, and even the movie Fargo. The way they tied up Dodd's feet, looking upside down like the wood chipper, and a million other things I can't remember.
I don't know if they'll do that or not. I hope they don't throw too much in on the last episode. And did you notice if it's longer?
Was that the last episode of season one where they showed that the grocery king got the money from the snow? I think it was. That would be cool. That would be cool to have that thread connect all three of these things so far.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it would. I mean, we've got plenty of connection. There wasn't a lot of connection of two to the movie other than that.
No, there's nothing yet. That's why I'm saying, what is it? What is the connection going to be?
No, I'm sorry. One to the movie other than the movie.
Yeah, we did. That was the strongest connection there could be.
Well, right. What I'm saying is that was the only connection, though, right, was the money. And we now have a big connection between one and two with Hank and Molly and, you know, I mean, with actual people. So they don't really need that. But
yeah,
I agree
they do. They need the connection directly to the movie, the money. The money is the MacGuffin that got the whole thing going. And that I think they need that thread. If they're going to do that in season one, why not do it in season two? And I think if they're going to do the thread, it has to be the money. So I would expect to see something about the money in the final episode here.
Okay. Well, that'd be good if they show it. I mean, I would love it. I'm not counting on it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how they would explain it. All right. Well, that's it for 209 The Castle. Next week's 210 Palindrome. Michelle, how do people reach you?
On Twitter, at Michelle from TN.
And I'm at Scathing Tweets. So I'll see you next week on Palindrome, Michelle.